and family next door, arriving home in their pickup loaded with ladders after a long day of painting houses, greeted at the fence by their yapping dogs. Our neighborhood was middle class and racially mixed. Kids found one another based not on the color of their skin, but on who was outside and ready to play. My friends included a girl named Rachel, whose mother was white and had a British accent, Susie, a curly-haired redhead, and the Mendoza's granddaughter whenever she was visiting. We were a motley mix of last names. Consapant, Abu Asaf, Yacker, Robinson, and were too young to register that things around us were changing fast. In 1950, 15 years before my parents moved to South Shore, the neighborhood had been 96% white. By the time I'd leave for college in 1981, it would be about 96% black. Craig and I were raised squarely in the crosscurrents of that flux. The blocks surrounding us were home to Jewish families, immigrant families, white and black families, folks who were thriving and some who were not. In general, people tended to their lawns and kept track of their children. They wrote checks to Robbie so their kids could learn piano. My family, in fact, was probably on the poor side of the neighborhood spectrum. We were among the few people we knew who didn't own their home, stuffed as we were into Robbie and Terry's second floor. South Shore hadn't yet tilted the way other neighborhoods had, with the better-off people long departed for the suburbs, the neighborhood businesses closing one by one, the blight setting in. But the tilt was clearly beginning. We were starting to feel the effects of this transition, especially at school. My second grade classroom turned out to be a mayhem of unruly kids and flying erasers, which had not been the norm in either my experience or Craig's. All this seemed due to a teacher who couldn't figure out how to assert control, who didn't seem to like children even. Beyond that, it wasn't clear that anyone was particularly bothered by the fact that the teacher was incompetent. The students used it as an excuse to act out, and she seemed to think only the worst of us. In her eyes, we were a class of bad kids, though we had no guidance and no structure and had been sentenced to a grim, underlit room in the basement of the school. Every hour there felt hellish and long. I sat miserably at my desk, in my puke green chair, puke green being the official color of the 1970s, learning nothing and waiting for the midday lunch break when I could go home and have a sandwich and complain to my mom. When I got angry as a kid, I almost always funneled it through my mother. As I fumed about my new teacher, she listened placidly, saying things like, "Oh dear," and "Oh really." She never indulged my outrage, but she took my frustration seriously. If my mother were somebody different, she might have done the polite thing and said, "Just go and do your best." But she knew the difference. She knew the difference between whining and actual distress. Without telling me, she went over to the school and began a weeks-long process of behind-the-scenes lobbying, which led to me and a couple of other high-performing kids getting quietly pulled out of the class, given a battery of tests, and about a week later reinstalled permanently into a bright and orderly third-grade class upstairs, governed by a smiling, no-nonsense teacher who knew her stuff. It was a small but life-changing move. I didn't stop to ask myself then, what would happen to all the kids who'd been left in the basement with the teacher who couldn't teach? Now that I'm an adult, I realize that kids know at a very young age when they're being devalued, when adults aren't invested enough to help them learn. Their anger over it can manifest itself as unruliness. It's hardly their fault. They aren't bad kids. They're just trying to survive bad circumstances. At the time, though, I was just happy to have escaped. But I learned many years later that my mother, who is by nature wry and quiet, but generally also the most forthright person in any room, made a point of seeking out the second grade teacher and telling her as kindly as possible that she had no business teaching and should be working as a drugstore cashier instead. As time went by, my mother started nudging me to go outside and engage with kids in the neighborhood. She was hoping that I'd learn to glide socially the way my brother had. Craig, as I've mentioned, had a way of making hard things look easy. He was by then a growing sensation on the basketball court, high-spirited and agile and quickly growing tall. My father pushed him to seek out the toughest competition he could, which meant that he would later send Craig across town on his own to play with the best kids in the city. But for now, he left him to wrangle the neighborhood talent. Craig would take his ball and carry it across the street to Rosenbloom Park, passing the monkey bars and swing set where I liked to play, and then cross an invisible line, disappearing through a veil of trees to the far side of the park, where the basketball courts were. I thought of it as an abyss over there, a mythic dark forest of drunks and thugs and criminal goings-on. But Craig, once he started visiting that side of the park, would set me straight, saying that really nobody over there was all that bad. Basketball for my brother seemed to unlock every frontier. It taught him how to approach strangers when he wanted to snag a spot in a pickup game. He learned how to talk a friendly form of smack, trash-talking his bigger, faster opponents on the court. It helped, too, to debunk various myths about who was who and what was what around the neighborhood, reinforcing the possibility, something that had long been a credo of my dad's, that most people were good people if you just treated them well. Even the sketchy guys who hung out in front of the corner liquor store lit up when they spotted Craig, calling his name and high-fiving him as we passed. "How do you even know them?" I'd ask, incredulous. "I don't know, they just know me," he'd say with a shrug. I was 10 when I finally mellowed enough to start venturing out myself, a decision driven in large part by boredom. It was summer and school was out. Craig and I rode a bus to Lake Michigan every day to go to a rec camp run by the city at a beachfront park. But we'd be back home by 4, with many daylight hours still to fill. My dolls were becoming less interesting, and without air conditioning, our apartment got unbearably hot in the late afternoons. And so I started tailing Craig around the neighborhood, meeting the kids I didn't already know from school. Across the alley behind our house, there was a mini housing community called Euclid Parkway, where about 15 homes had been built around a common green space. It was a kind of paradise, free from cars and full of kids, playing softball and jumping double dutch or sitting on stoops just hanging out. But before I could find my way into the fold of girls my age who hung out at the parkway, I faced a test. It came in the form of Dee Dee, a girl who went to a nearby Catholic school. Dee Dee was athletic and pretty, but she wore her face in a pout and was always ready with an eye roll. She often sat on her family's stoop next to another more popular girl named Deneen. Deneen was always friendly, but Dee Dee didn't seem to like me. I don't know why. Every time I went over to Euclid Parkway, she'd make quiet, cutting remarks, as if just by showing up I'd managed to ruin everyone's day. As the summer went on, Dee Dee's comments only grew louder. My morale began to sink. I understood that I had choices. I could continue on as the picked-on new girl. I could give up on the parkway and just go back to my toys at home. Or I could attempt to earn Dee Dee's respect. And inside that last choice lay another one. I could try to reason with Dee Dee to win her over with words or some other form of kid diplomacy, Or I could just shut her up. The next time Dee Dee made one of her remarks, I lunged for her, summoning everything my dad had taught me about how to throw a punch. The two of us fell to the ground, fists flailing and legs thrashing. Every kid in Euclid Parkway instantly clustered in a tight knot around us, their hollers fueled by excitement and grade school bloodlust. I can't remember who finally pulled us apart, whether it was Deneen or my brother or maybe a parent who'd been called to the scene. But when it was done, some sort of silent baptism had taken place. I was officially an accepted member of the neighborhood tribe. Dee Dee and I were unharmed, dirt-stained, and panting, and destined never to be close friends. But at least I'd earned her respect. My dad's Buick continued to be our shelter, our window to the world. We took it out on Sundays and summer evenings, cruising for no reason but the fact that we could. Sometimes we'd end up in a neighborhood to the south, an area known as Pill Hill, due to an apparently large number of African-American doctors living there. It was one of the prettier, more affluent parts of the South Side, where people kept two cars in the driveway and had abundant beds of flowers blooming along their walkways. My father viewed rich people with a shade of suspicion. He didn't like people who were uppity and had mixed feelings about home ownership in general. There was a short period when he and my mom considered buying a home for sale not far from Robbie's house, driving over one day to inspect the place with a real estate agent, but ultimately deciding against it. At the time, I'd been all for it. In my mind, I thought it would mean something if my family could live in a place with more than one floor. But my father was innately cautious, aware of the trade-offs, understanding the need to maintain some savings for a rainy day. "You never want to be house poor," he'd tell us, explaining how some people handed over their savings and borrowed too much, ending up with a nice home, but no freedom at all. My parents talked to us like we were adults. They didn't lecture, but rather indulge every question we asked, no matter how juvenile. They never hurried a discussion for the sake of convenience. Our talks could go on for hours, often because Craig and I took every opportunity to grill my parents about things we didn't understand. When we were little, we'd ask, "Why do people go to the bathroom?" or "Why do you need a job?" and then blitz them with follow-ups. One of my early Socratic victories came from a question driven by self-interest. "Why do we have to eat eggs for breakfast?" which led to a discussion about the necessity of protein, which led me to ask why peanut butter couldn't count as protein, which eventually, after more debate, led to my mother revising her stance on eggs, which I had never liked to eat in the first place. For the next 9 years, knowing that I'd earned it, I'd made myself a fat peanut butter and jelly sandwich for breakfast each morning and consumed not a single egg. As we grew, we spoke more often about drugs and sex and life choices, about race and inequality and politics. My parents didn't expect us to be saints. My father, I remember, made a point of saying that sex was and should be fun. They also never sugarcoated what they took to be the harder truths about life. Craig, for example, got a new bike one summer and rode it east to Lake Michigan, to the paved pathway along Rainbow Beach, where you could feel the breeze off the water. He'd been promptly picked up by a police officer who accused him of stealing it, unwilling to accept that a young black boy would have come across a new bike in an honest way. The officer, an African-American man himself, ultimately got a brutal tongue-lashing from my mother, who made him apologize to Craig. What had happened, my parents told us, was unjust, but also unfortunately common. The color of our skin made us vulnerable. It was a thing we'd always have to navigate. My father's habit of driving us through Pill Hill was a bit of an aspirational exercise, I would guess. a chance to show us what a good education could yield. My parents had spent almost their entire lives living within a couple of square miles in Chicago, but they had no illusions that Craig and I would do the same. Before they were married, both of them had briefly attended community colleges, but each had abandoned the exercise long before getting a degree. My mother had been studying to become a teacher, but realized she'd rather work as a secretary. My father had simply run out of money to pay tuition, joining the army instead. He'd had no one in his family to talk him into returning to school, no model of what that sort of life looked like. Instead, he served 2 years moving between different military bases. If finishing college and becoming an artist had been a dream for my father, he quickly redirected his hopes, using his wages to help pay for his younger brother's degree in architecture instead. Now in his late 30s, my dad was focused on saving for us kids. Our family was never going to be house poor because we weren't going to own a house. My father operated from a practical place, sensing that resources were limited and maybe so too was time. When he wasn't driving, he now used a cane to get around. Before I finished elementary school, that cane would become a crutch, and soon after that, two crutches. Whatever was eroding inside my father, withering his muscles and stripping his nerves, he viewed it as his own private challenge, as something to silently withstand. As a family, we sustained ourselves with humble luxuries. When Craig and I got our report cards at school, our parents celebrated by ordering in a pizza from Italian Fiesta, our favorite place. During hot weather, we'd buy hand-packed ice cream, a pint each of chocolate, butter pecan, and black cherry, and make it last for days. Every year for the Air and Water Show, we packed a picnic and drove north along Lake Michigan to the fenced-off peninsula where my father's water filtration plant was located. It was one of the few times a year when employee families were allowed through the gates and onto a grassy lawn overlooking the lake, where the view of fighter jets swooping in formation over the water rivaled that of any penthouse on Lakeshore Drive. Each July, my dad would take a week off from his job tending boilers at the plant, and we'd pile into the Buick with an aunt and a couple of cousins, seven of us in that two-door 4 hours, taking the Skyway out of Chicago, skirting the south end of Lake Michigan, and driving until we landed in White Cloud, Michigan, at a place called Duke's Happy Holiday Resort. It had a game room, a vending machine that sold glass bottles of pop, and most important to us, a big outdoor swimming pool. We rented a cabin with a kitchenette and passed our days jumping in and out of the water. My parents barbecued, smoked cigarettes, and played cards with my aunt, but my father also took long breaks to join us kids in the pool. He was handsome, my dad, with a mustache that tipped down the sides of his lips like a scythe. His chest and arms were thick and roped with muscle, testament to the athlete he'd once been. During those long afternoons in the pool, he paddled and laughed and tossed our small bodies into the air, his diminished legs suddenly less of a liability. Decline can be a hard thing to measure, especially when you're in the midst of it. Every September, when Craig and I showed up back at Bryn Mawr Elementary, we'd find fewer white kids on the playground. Some had transferred to a nearby Catholic school, but many had left the neighborhood altogether. At first, it felt as if just the white families were leaving, but then that changed too. It soon seemed that anyone who had the means to go was now going. Much of the time, the departures went unannounced and unexplained. We'd see a for sale sign in front of the Yacker family's house, or a moving van in front of Teddy's, and knew what was coming. Perhaps the biggest blow to my mother came when her friend, Velma Stewart, announced that she and her husband had put a down payment on a house in a suburb called Park Forest. The Stewarts had two kids and lived down the block on Euclid. Like us, they were apartment dwellers. Mrs. Stewart had a wicked sense of humor and a big infectious laugh, which drew my mother to her. The two of them swapped recipes and kept up with each other, but never fell into the neighborhood's gossip cycle the way other mothers did. Mrs. Stewart's son Donnie was Craig's age and just as athletic, giving the two of them an instant bond. Her daughter, Pamela, was a teenager already and not so interested in me, though I found all teenagers intriguing. I don't remember much about Mr. Stewart, except that he drove a delivery truck for one of the big bakery companies in the city, and that he and his wife and their kids were the lightest-skinned black people I'd ever met. How they afforded a place in the suburbs, I couldn't guess. Park Forest, it turns out, was one of America's first fully planned communities. Not just a housing subdivision, but a full village designed for about 30,000 people with shopping malls, churches, schools, and parks. Founded in 1948, it was in many ways meant to be the paragon of suburban life, with mass-produced houses and cookie-cutter yards. There were also quotas for how many black families could live on a given block, though by the time the Stewarts got there, the quotas had apparently been abolished. Not long after they moved, the Stewarts invited us to come visit them on one of my dad's days off. We were excited. For us, it would be a new kind of outing, a chance to glimpse the fabled suburbs. The four of us took the Buick south on the expressway, following the road out of Chicago, exiting about 40 minutes later near a sterile-looking shopping plaza. We were soon winding through a network of quiet streets, following Mrs. Stewart's directions, turning from one nearly identical block to the next. Park Forest was like a miniature city of tract homes, modest ranch-style places with soft gray shingles and newly planted saplings and bushes out front. "Now, why would anyone want to live all the way out here?" my father asked, staring over the dashboard. I agreed that it made no sense. As far as I could see, there were no big trees like the giant oak that sat outside my bedroom window at home. Everything in Park Forest was new and wide and uncrowded. There was no corner liquor store with ratty guys hanging out in front of it. There were no cars honking or sirens. There was no music floating from anybody's kitchen. The windows in the houses all looked to be shut. Craig would remember our visit there as heavenly, namely because he played ball all day long in the wide-open lots under a blue sky with Donnie Stewart and his new pack of suburban brethren. My parents had a pleasant enough catch-up with Mr. and Mrs. Stewart, and I followed Pamela around, gaping at her hair, her fair skin, and teenage jewelry. At some point, we all had lunch. It was evening when we finally said goodbye. Leaving the Stewarts, we walked in the dusk to the curb where my dad had parked the car. Craig was sweaty, dead on his feet after all the running he'd done. I, too, was fatigued and ready to go home. Something about the place had put me on edge. I wasn't a fan of the suburbs, though I couldn't articulate exactly why. My mother would later make an observation about the Stewarts and their new community based on the fact that almost all of their neighbors on the street seemed to be white. "I wonder," she said, "if anybody knew they're a black family until we came to visit." She thought that maybe we'd unwittingly outed them, arriving from the South Side with a housewarming gift and our conspicuous dark skin. Even if the Stewarts weren't deliberately trying to hide their race, they probably didn't speak of it one way or another with their new neighbors. Whatever vibe existed on their block, they hadn't overtly disrupted it, at least not until we came to visit. Was somebody watching through a window as my father approached our car that night? Was there a shadow behind some curtain, waiting to see how things would go? I'll never know. I just remember the way my dad's body stiffened slightly when he reached the driver's side door and saw what was there. Someone had scratched a line across the side of his beloved Buick, a thin, ugly gulch that ran across the door and toward the tail of the car. It had been done with a key or a rock and was in no way an accident. I've said before that my father was a withstander, a man who never complained about small things or big, who cheerily ate liver when it was served to him, who had a doctor give him what amounted to a death sentence and then just carried on. This thing with the car was no different. If there was some way to fight it, if there was some door to pound in response, my dad wouldn't have done it anyway. "Well, I'll be damned," he said before unlocking the car. We rode back to the city that night without much discussion about what had happened. It was too exhausting maybe to parse. In any event, we were done with the suburbs. My father must have had to drive the car to work the next day looking the way it did, and I'm sure that didn't sit well with him. But the gash in his chrome didn't stay for long. As soon as there was time, he took the car over to the body shop at Sears and had it erased. 3. Somewhere along the way, my normally laid-back brothers started sprouting worries. I can't say exactly when or why this began, but Craig, the boy who could high-five and what-up his way around the neighborhood, who blithely catnapped any time he had 10 free minutes, regardless of his surroundings, grew more fretful and vigilant at home, convinced that catastrophe was creeping our way. In the evenings at our apartment, he rehearsed for every outcome, immersing himself in hypotheticals the rest of us found bizarre. Worried he'd lose his sight, he took to wearing a blindfold around the house, learning to navigate our living room and kitchen by feel. Worried he might go deaf, he began teaching himself sign language. There was also apparently the threat of amputation, prompting Craig to fumble his way through various meals and homework sessions with his right hand tied behind his back. Because you never did know. Craig's biggest fear, however, was also probably the most realistic, and that was fire. House fires were a regular occurrence in Chicago, in part due to slumlords who let their buildings slide into disrepair and were all too happy to reap the insurance benefits when a fire tore through, and in part because home smoke detectors were a relatively new development and still expensive for working-class people to afford. Either way, inside our tight city grid, fire was almost a fact of life. A random but persistent snatcher of homes and hearts. My grandfather Southside had moved to our neighborhood after a fire destroyed his old house on the west side, though luckily nobody'd been hurt. According to my mother, Southside stood on the curb outside the burning house, shouting for the firefighters to direct their hoses away from his precious jazz albums. More recently, in a tragedy almost too giant for my young mind to take in, one of my fifth-grade classmates, a boy with a sweet face and a tall afro named Lester McCullum, who lived around the corner from us in a townhouse on 74th Street, had died in a fire that also killed his brother and sister, the three of them trapped by flames in bedrooms upstairs. Theirs was the first wake I ever attended. Every kid in the neighborhood sobbing at the funeral parlor as a Jackson 5 album played softly in the background, the adults stunned into silence, no prayer or platitude capable of filling the void. There were three closed caskets at the front of the room, each one with a framed photograph of a smiling child on its lid. Mrs. McCullum, who with her husband had managed to survive the fire by jumping out a window, sat before them, so slumped and broken that it hurt to look in her direction. For days afterward, the skeleton of the McCullum's burned-out townhouse continued to hiss and cave in on itself, dying far more slowly than its young occupants had. The smell of smoke lingered heavily in the neighborhood. As time passed, Craig's anxieties only grew. At school, we'd be put through the paces of teacher-led evacuation drills, dutifully enduring lectures on how to stop, drop, and roll. And as a result, Craig decided that we needed to step it up on safety at home, electing himself the family fire marshal with me as his lieutenant, ready to clear exit pathways during drills or boss around our parents as needed. We weren't so much convinced we'd have a fire as we were fixated on being ready for one. Preparation mattered. Our family was not just punctual, we arrived early to everything, knowing that it made my dad less vulnerable, sparing him from having to worry about finding a parking spot that didn't require him to walk a long way or an accessible seat in the bleachers of one of Craig's basketball games. The lesson being that in life, you control what you can. To this end, as kids, we ran through our escape route possibilities, trying to guess whether we could jump from a window to the oak tree in front of the house or to a neighbor's rooftop in the event of a fire. We imagined what would happen if a grease fire broke out in the kitchen, or if an electrical fire started in the basement, or if lightning struck from above. Craig and I had little concern about our mom in an emergency. She was small and agile and one of those people who, if her adrenaline got going, could probably bench press a car off a baby. What was harder to talk about was Dad's disability. The obvious but unstated truth that he couldn't readily leap from a window like the rest of us, and it had been years since we'd seen him run. Should things get scary, we realized, our rescue wouldn't unfold the way rescues did in the tidy after-school movies we watched on TV. It would not be our dad who'd throw us over his shoulder with Herculean grace and carry us to safety. If anyone, it would have to be Craig, who would eventually tower over my father, but was then still a narrow-shouldered, spindle-legged boy who seemed to understand that any heroics on his part would require practice. Which is why during our family fire drills, he started conjuring the worst-case scenarios, ordering my dad to the floor, instructing him to lie there limp and heavy as a sack as if he'd passed out from smoke inhalation. "Oh, good Lord," Dad would say, shaking his head. "You really going to do this?" My father was not accustomed to being helpless. He lived his life in defiance of that very prospect, assiduously looking after our car, paying the bills on time, never discussing his advancing multiple sclerosis nor missing a day of work. To the contrary, my father loved to be the rock for others. What he couldn't do physically, he substituted with emotional and intellectual guidance and support, which is why he enjoyed his work as a precinct captain for the city's Democratic Party. He'd held the post for years, in part because loyal service to the party machine was more or less expected of city employees. Even if he'd been half forced into it, though, my dad loved the job, which baffled my mother given the amount of time it demanded. He paid weekend visits to a nearby neighborhood to check in on his constituents, often with me reluctantly in tow. We'd park the car and walk along streets of modest bungalows, landing on a doorstep to find a hunched-over widow or a big-bellied factory worker with a can of Michelob peering through the screen door. Often these people were delighted by the sight of my father smiling broadly on their porch, propped up by his cane. "Well, Frazier," they'd say, "what a surprise. Get on in here." For me, this was never good news. It meant we were going inside. It meant that my whole Saturday afternoon would now get sucked up as I got parked on a musty sofa or with a 7-Up at a kitchen table while my dad fielded feedback, complaints really, that he'd then pass on to the elected alderman who controlled the ward. When somebody had problems with garbage pickup or snow plowing or was irritated by a pothole, My dad was there to listen. His purpose was to help people feel cared for by the Democrats and to vote accordingly when elections rolled around. To my dismay, he never rushed anyone along. Time, as far as my father was concerned, was a gift you gave to other people. He clucked approvingly at pictures of cute grandkids, patiently endured gossip and long litanies of health woes, and nodded knowingly at stories about how money was tight. He hugged the old ladies as we finally left their houses, assuring them he'd do his best to be useful, to get the fixable issues fixed. My dad had faith in his own utility. It was a point of pride, which is why at home during our fire drills, he had little interest in being a passive prop, even in a pretend crisis. He had no intention under any circumstance of being a liability, of winding up the unconscious guy on the floor. But still, some part of him seemed to understand that this mattered to us, to Craig in particular. When we asked him to lie down, he'd humor us, dropping first to his knees, then to his butt, then spreading himself out obligingly, facing up on the living room carpet. He'd exchange glances with my mother, who found it all a little funny, as if to say, "These damn kids." With a sigh, he'd close his eyes, waiting to feel Craig's hands hook themselves solidly beneath his shoulders to start the rescue operation. My mother and I would then watch, as with no small amount of effort and a good deal of awkwardness, my brother managed to drag 170 or so pounds of paternal dead weight backward through the imaginary inferno that raged in his pre-adolescent mind, hauling my father across the floor, rounding the couch, and finally making it to the stairwell. From here, Craig figured he could probably slide my dad's body down the stairs and out the side door to safety. My father always refused to let him practice this part, saying gently, "That's enough now," and insisting on getting back to his feet before Craig could try to lug him down the stairs. But between the small man and the grown man, the point had been made. None of this would be easy or comfortable if it came to it. And there were, of course, no guarantees that any of us would survive. But if the very worst happened, we at least had a plan. Slowly, I was becoming more outward and social, more willing to open myself up to the messes of the wider world. My natural resistance to chaos and spontaneity had been worn down somewhat through all the hours I'd spent trailing my father through his precinct visits, plus all the other weekend outings we made, dropping in on our dozens of aunts, uncles, and cousins, sitting in thick clouds of barbecue smoke in someone's backyard, or running around with neighborhood kids in a neighborhood that wasn't ours. My mother was one of seven children in her family. My father was the oldest of five. My mother's relatives tended to gather at Southside's house around the corner, drawn by my grandfather's cooking, the ongoing games of bidwis, and the exuberant blasting of jazz. Southside acted as a magnet for us all. He was forever mistrustful of the world beyond his own yard, worried primarily about everyone's safety and well-being, and as a result poured his energy into creating an environment where we were always well-fed and entertained, likely with the hope we'd never want to move away from it. He even got me a dog, an affable, cinnamon-colored shepherd mutt we called Rex. Per my mother's orders, Rex wasn't allowed to live at our house, but I'd visit him all the time at Southside's, lying on the floor with my face buried in his soft fur, listening to his tail thwap appreciatively anytime Southside walked past. Southside spoiled the dog the same way he spoiled me, with food and love and tolerance, all of it a silent, earnest plea never to leave him. My father's family, meanwhile, sprawled across Chicago's broader South Side and included an array of great aunts and third cousins, plus a few stray outliers whose blood connection remained cloudy. We orbited between all of them. I quietly assessed where we were going by the number of trees I'd see on the street outside. The poorer neighborhoods often had no trees at all. But to my dad, everyone was kin. He lit up when he saw his Uncle Callio, a skinny, wavy-haired little man who looked like Sammy Davis Jr. and was almost always drunk. He adored his Aunt Verdell, who lived with her 8 children in a neglected apartment building next to the Dan Ryan Expressway in a neighborhood where Craig and I understood that the rules of survival were very different. On Sunday afternoons, all 4 of us normally took the 10-minute drive north to Parkway Gardens to eat dinner with my dad's parents, whom we called Dandy and Grandma, and his 3 youngest siblings, Andrew, Carlton, and Francesca, who'd been born more than a decade after my father and thus seemed more like sister and brothers to us than aunt and uncles. My father, I thought, seemed more like a father and less like a brother with the 3 of them, offering them advice and slipping them cash when they needed it. Francesca was smart and beautiful and sometimes let me brush her long hair. Andrew and Carlton were in their early 20s and dazzlingly hip. They wore bell bottoms and turtlenecks. They owned leather jackets, had girlfriends, and talked about things like Malcolm X and soul power. Craig and I passed hours in their bedroom at the back of the apartment, just trying to sponge up their cool. My grandfather, also named Fraser Robinson, was decidedly less fun to be around. A cigar-puffing patriarch who'd sit in his recliner with a newspaper on his lap and the evening news blaring on the television nearby. His demeanor was nothing like my father's. For Dandy, everything was an irritant. He was galled by the day's headlines, by the state of the world as shown on TV, by the young black men, boo-boos he'd call them, who he perceived to be hanging uselessly around the neighborhood, giving black people everywhere a bad name. He shouted at the television. He shouted at my grandmother, a sweet, soft-spoken woman and devout Christian named LaVon. My parents had named me Michelle LaVon Robinson in honor of her. By day, my grandmother expertly managed a thriving Bible bookstore on the far south side, but in her off hours with Dandy, she was reduced to a meekness I found perplexing, even as a young girl. She cooked his meals and absorbed his barrage of complaints and said nothing in her own defense. Even at a young age, there was something about my grandmother's silence and passivity in her relationship with Dandy that got under my skin. According to my mother, I was the only person in the family to talk back to Dandy when he yelled. I did it regularly from the time I was very young and over many years, in part because it drove me crazy that my grandmother wouldn't speak up for herself, in part because everyone else fell silent around him, and lastly, because I loved Dandy as much as he confounded me. His stubbornness was something I recognized, something I'd inherited myself, though I hoped in a less abrasive form. There was also a softness in Dandy, which I caught only in glimmers. He tenderly rubbed my neck sometimes when I sat at the foot of his reclining chair. He smiled when my dad said something funny or one of us kids managed to slip a sophisticated word into a conversation. But then something would set him off, and he'd start snarling again. "Quit shouting at everyone, Dandy," I'd say, or "Don't be mean to Grandma." Often, I'd add, "What's got you so mad anyway?" The answer to that question was both complicated and simple. Dandy himself would leave it unanswered, shrugging crankily in response to my interference and returning to his newspaper. Back at home, though, my parents would try to explain. Dandy was from the South Carolina Lowcountry, having grown up in the humid seaport of Georgetown, where thousands of slaves once labored on vast plantations, harvesting crops of rice and indigo and making their owners rich. My grandfather, born in 1912, was the grandson of slaves, the son of a mill worker, the oldest of what would be 10 children in his family. A quick-witted and intelligent kid, he'd been nicknamed the Professor and set his sights early on the idea of someday going to college. But not only was he Black and from a poor family, he also came of age during the Great Depression. After finishing high school, Dandy went to work at a lumber mill, knowing that if he stayed in Georgetown, his options would never widen. When the mill eventually closed, like many African Americans of his generation, he took a chance and moved north to Chicago, joining what became known as the Great Migration, in which 6 million Southern Blacks relocated to big northern cities over the course of 5 decades, fleeing racial oppression and chasing industrial jobs. If this were an American dream story, Dandy, who arrived in Chicago in the early 1930s, would have found a good job and a pathway to college. But the reality was far different. Jobs were hard to come by, limited at least somewhat by the fact that managers at some of the big factories in Chicago regularly hired European immigrants over African American workers. Dandy took what work he could find, setting pins in a bowling alley and freelancing as a handyman. Gradually, he downgraded his hopes, letting go of the idea of college, thinking he'd train to become an electrician instead. But this too was quickly thwarted. If you wanted to work as an electrician, or as a steelworker, carpenter, or plumber for that matter, on any of the big job sites in Chicago, you needed a union card. And if you were Black, the overwhelming odds were that you weren't going to get one. This particular form of discrimination altered the destinies of generations of African Americans, including many of the men in my family, limiting their income, their opportunity, and eventually their aspirations. As a carpenter, Southside wasn't allowed to work for the larger construction firms that offered steady pay on long-term projects, given that he couldn't join a labor union. My great uncle Terry, Robbie's husband, had abandoned a career as a plumber for the same reason, instead becoming a Pullman porter. There was also Uncle Pete on my mother's side, who'd been unable to join the taxi drivers union and instead turned to driving an unlicensed jitney, picking up customers who lived in the less safe parts of the West Side, where normal cabs didn't like to go. These were highly intelligent, able-bodied men who were denied access to stable, high-paying jobs, which in turn kept them from being able to buy homes, send their kids to college, or save for retirement. It pained them, I know, to be cast aside, to be stuck in jobs they were overqualified for, to watch white people leapfrog past them at work, sometimes training new employees they knew might one day become their bosses. And it bred within each of them at least a basic level of resentment and mistrust. You never quite knew what other folks saw you to be. As for Dandy, life wasn't all bad. He met my grandmother while attending church on the South Side and ultimately found work through the federal government's Works Progress Administration, the relief program that hired unskilled laborers for public construction projects during the Depression. He then went on to log 30 years as a postal worker before retiring with a pension that helped allow him all that time to yell at the boo-boos on TV from the comfort of his recliner. In the end, he had 5 kids who were as smart and disciplined as he was. Nominee, his second child, would end up with a degree from Harvard Business School. Andrew and Carlton would go on to become a train conductor and an engineer, respectively. Francesca worked as a creative director in advertising for a time and eventually became a grade school teacher. But still, Dandy would remain unable to see his children's accomplishments as any sort of extension of his. As we saw every Sunday arriving at Parkway Gardens for dinner, my grandfather lived with a bitter residue of his own dashed dreams. If my questions for Dandy were hard and unanswerable, I soon learned that many questions are just that way. In my own life, I was starting to encounter questions I couldn't readily answer. One came from a girl, whose name I can't remember, one of the distant cousins who played with us in the backyard of one of my great aunt's bungalows farther west of us, part of the loosely related crowd that often turned up when my parents drove over for a visit. As the adults drank coffee and laughed in the kitchen, a parallel scene would unfold outside as Craig and I joined whatever pack of kids came with those adults. Sometimes it was awkward, all of us managing a forced camaraderie, but generally it worked out. Craig almost always disappeared into a basketball game. I'd jump double dutch or try to fall into whatever banter was going on. One summer day, when I was about 10, I sat on a stoop, chatting with a group of girls my age. We were all in pigtails and shorts and basically just killing time. What were we discussing? It could have been anything. School, our older brothers, an anthill on the ground. At one point, one of the girls, a second, third, or fourth cousin of mine, gave me a sideways look and said, "Just a touch hotly, how come you talk like a white girl?" The question was pointed, meant as an insult, or at least a challenge, but it also came from an earnest place. It held a kernel of something that was confusing for both of us. We seemed to be related, but of two different worlds. "I don't," I said, looking scandalized that she'd even suggest it, and mortified by the way the other girls were now staring at me. But I knew what she was getting at. There was no denying it, even if I just had. I did speak differently than some of my relatives, and so did Craig. Our parents had drilled into us the importance of using proper diction, of saying going instead of going, and isn't instead of ain't. We were taught to finish off our words. They bought us a dictionary and a full Encyclopedia Britannica set, which lived on a shelf in the stairwell to our apartment, its titles etched in gold. Anytime we had a question about a word or a concept or some piece of history, they directed us towards those books. Dandy, too, was an influence, meticulously correcting our grammar or admonishing us to enunciate our words when we went over for dinner. The idea was we were to transcend, to get ourselves further. They planned for it. They encouraged it. We were expected not just to be smart, but to own our smartness, to inhabit it with pride, and this filtered down to how we spoke. Yet it also could be problematic. Speaking a certain way, the white way, as some would have it, was perceived as a betrayal, as being uppity, as somehow denying our culture. Years later, after I'd met and married my husband, a man who is light-skinned to some and dark-skinned to others, who speaks like an Ivy League-educated Black Hawaiian raised by white middle-class Kansans, I'd see this confusion play out on the national stage among whites and blacks alike, the need to situate someone inside his or her ethnicity and the frustration that comes when it can't easily be done. America would bring to Barack Obama the same questions my cousin was unconsciously putting to me that day on the stoop. "Are you what you appear to be? Do I trust you or not?" I passed the rest of that day trying to say less to my cousin, feeling put off by her hostility, but also wanting her to see me as genuine, not trying to flaunt some advantage. It was hard to know what to do. All the while, I could hear the trickle of conversation going on between the adults in the kitchen nearby, my parents' laughter ringing easy and loud over the yard. I watched my brother in the flow of a sweaty game with a group of boys on the adjacent street corner. Everyone seemed to fit in, except for me. I look back on the discomfort of that moment now and recognize the more universal challenge of squaring who you are with where you come from and where you want to go. I also realize that I was a long way still from finding my voice. 4. At school, we were given an hour-long break for lunch each day. Because my mother didn't work and our apartment was so close by, I usually marched home with 4 or 5 other girls in tow, all of us talking nonstop, ready to sprawl on the kitchen floor to play jacks and watch All My Children while my mom handed out sandwiches. This, for me, began a habit that has sustained me for life, keeping a close and high-spirited council of girlfriends, a safe harbor of female wisdom. In my lunch group, we dissected whatever had gone on that morning at school, any beefs we had with teachers, any assignments that struck us as useless. Our opinions were largely formed by committee. We idolized the Jacksons and weren't sure how we felt about the Osmonds. Watergate had happened, but none of us understood it. Seemed like a lot of old white guys talking into microphones in Washington, D.C., which to us was just a faraway city filled with a lot of white buildings and white men. My mom, meanwhile, was plenty happy to serve us. It gave her an easy window into our world. As my friends and I ate and gossiped, she often stood by quietly, engaged in some household chore, not hiding the fact that she was taking in every word. In my family, with 4 of us packed into less than 900 square feet of living space, we'd never had any privacy anyway. It mattered only sometimes. Craig, who was suddenly interested in girls, had started taking his phone calls behind closed doors in the bathroom. The phone's curly-cue cord stretched taut across the hallway from its wall-mounted base in the kitchen. As Chicago Public Schools went, Bryn Mawr fell somewhere between a bad school and a good school. Racial and economic sorting in the South Shore neighborhood continued through the 1970s, meaning that the student population only grew blacker and poorer with each year. There was, for a time, a citywide integration movement to bus kids to new schools, but Bryn Mawr parents had successfully fought it off, arguing that the money was better spent improving the school itself. As a kid, I had no perspective on whether the facilities were run down or whether it mattered that there were hardly any white kids left. The school ran from kindergarten all the way through 8th grade, which meant that by the time I'd reached the upper grades, I knew every light switch, every chalkboard, and crack patch of hallway. I knew nearly every teacher and most of the kids. For me, Bryn Mawr was practically an extension of home. As I was entering 7th grade, the Chicago Defender, a weekly newspaper that was popular with African-American readers, ran a vitriolic opinion piece that claimed Bryn Mawr had gone in the span of a few years from being one of the city's best public schools to a rundown slum governed by a ghetto mentality. Our school principal, Dr. Leviso, immediately hit back with a letter to the editor defending his community of parents and students and deeming the newspaper's piece an outrageous lie, which seems designed to incite only feelings of failure and flight. Dr. Leviso was a round, cheery man who had an afro that puffed out on either side of his bald spot and who spent most of his time in an office near the building's front door. It's clear from his letter that he understood precisely what he was up against. Failure is a feeling long before it becomes an actual result. It's vulnerability that breeds with self-doubt and then is escalated, often deliberately, by fear. Those feelings of failure, he mentioned, were everywhere already in my neighborhood, in the form of parents who couldn't get ahead financially, of kids who were starting to suspect that their lives would be no different, of families who watched their better-off neighbors leave for the suburbs or transfer their children to Catholic schools. There were predatory real estate agents roaming South Shore all the while, whispering to homeowners that they should sell before it was too late, that they'd help them get out while you still can. the inference being that failure was coming, that it was inevitable, that it had already half arrived. You could get caught up in the ruin, or you could escape it. They used the word everyone was most afraid of, ghetto, dropping it like a lit match.